for sleep. He revealed his age, and it was true. He did look about 10 years older than he really was. Far too often, just having the knowledge is not enough to change our behavior and create real, lasting change. In the summer of 2009, I found myself suffering through this common pitfall myself. I was pushing so hard to bring this research to as many people as I could that I was crossing the Atlantic multiple times a month, cut off from my family and friends, and feeling overwhelmed. In short, the opposite of my book's prescription for success. It was a 10-hour plane ride from Zurich to Boston that finally broke this camel's back. Not just proverbially, but literally. Suddenly, a pain in my back and legs became so unbearable that I had to lie down in the back of the plane with help from one of the flight attendants. A hasty trip to the emergency room revealed that I had ruptured a disc in my back, so badly, in fact, that I spent the next month in a bed or lying on the floor. I had to get a massive cortisone epidural just so I could finally start walking again. Unable to travel or continue my research, I was forced to slow down, to finally spend some time putting these principles into practice in my own life. And I finally saw what I had been missing. These principles worked just as well for creating change for me in a personal crisis as they did for creating change for employees in the economic crisis. I will remain eternally grateful for that month because it gave me the time to practice what I had been preaching, to make those changes in my own mindset and behavior that I had urged of so many others. The point is that just listening to this book is not enough. It takes actual focus and effort to put these principles into practice, and only then will the returns start pouring in. The good news is that the returns are indeed enormous. The fact that each principle is based on years of hard science means that these ideas have been tested, retested, and proven effective. Books about how to get ahead in the workplace can be inspirational, but are often full of unproven strategies. On the other hand, science can be fascinating, but is often impossible to understand, much less translate into action. My goal in writing this book has been to bridge that gap. Part 2. The 7 Principles. Principle number 1. The Happiness Advantage. How happiness gives your brain and your organization the competitive edge. In 1543, Nicholas Copernicus published his treatise on the revolution of celestial spheres. Until then, most of the world believed that the Earth was the center of the universe and that the sun revolved around the planet. But Copernicus famously argued that precisely the opposite was true. Earth revolved around the sun, a revelation that eventually changed the way humans saw the entire universe. Today, a similar fundamental shift in the field of psychology is underway. For untold generations, we have been led to believe that happiness orbited around success, that if we work hard enough, we will be successful, and only if we are successful will we become happy. Success was thought to be the fixed point of the work universe, with happiness revolving around it. Now, thanks to breakthroughs in the burgeoning field of positive psychology, we are learning that the opposite is true. When we are happy, when our mindset and mood are positive, we are smarter, more motivated, and thus more successful. Happiness is the center, and success revolves around it. Unfortunately, despite the decades of research that tell us otherwise, many businesses and their leaders still cling stubbornly to their belief in this flawed order. The ruling powers continue to tell us that if we will just put our nose to the grindstone and work hard now, we will be successful, and therefore happier in some distant future. As we work toward our goals, happiness is either irrelevant or an easily dispensable luxury, or a reward only to be won after a lifetime of toil. Some even treat it as a weakness, a sign that we're not working hard enough. Every time we fall for this misguided creed, we undercut not only our mental and emotional well-being, but also our chances at success and achievement. The most successful people, the ones with the competitive edge, don't look to happiness as some distant reward for their achievements, nor grind through their days on neutral or negative. They are the ones who capitalize on the positive and reap the rewards at every turn. This chapter will show you how they do it, why it works, and how you too can profit. In its own way, the Happiness Advantage too is a Copernican revolution. It shows us that success orbits around happiness, not the other way around. Defining happiness. No one would talk to me. I was minutes away from speaking about the connection between happiness and performance at work to a group of executives from the Korean company Samsung, just waiting for the HR manager to introduce me to the room. I usually enjoy getting to know people during this brief interlude before a talk, but on this day, all the managers were staring ahead blankly, ignoring my repeated attempts at conversation. So I dejectedly pretended to fix my PowerPoint presentation, a surefire tactic for avoiding social awkwardness in these situations, though it works less well at cocktail parties. Finally, someone entered the room and introduced himself as Brian, the leader of the group. That's when I learned that the planners of this event had forgotten to mention one small detail. No one spoke any English. As it turns out, the translator Samsung usually hired for these occasions was out sick, so Brian offered to translate for me. As we began, he leaned over and confided, "I'm not great with languages." For the next 3 hours, I spoke in 1-minute bursts, turning after each one to my translator, who would proceed to either look very confused or animatedly start speaking to the group, usually for about 3 minutes longer than I had. I have no idea how accurately he was translating, but I do know he got all the credit for my jokes. Given how bumpy this process was, I decided to stop talking and instead encourage the executives to talk to one another. "To study how happiness affects performance," I said, "we need a definition. So that's the question I pose to you. What is happiness?" Pleased with my little last-minute exercise, I waited for Brian to translate what I had just said. Instead, he looked confused and leaned toward me. "You don't know what happiness means?" he asked nervously. My face froze. "No, I'm saying I'd like the group to come up with a definition of happiness." He covered his microphone and leaned in again, clearly trying not to embarrass me. "I can Google it for you." The Science of Happiness. While I was appreciative of the offer, not even the all-knowing Google has a definitive answer to this question. That's because there is no single meaning. Happiness is relative to the person experiencing it. This is why scientists often refer to it as subjective well-being, because it's based on how we feel about our own lives. In essence, the best judge of how happy you are is you. To empirically study happiness, then, scientists must rely on individual self-reports. Thankfully, after years of testing and honing survey questions on millions of people around the world, researchers have developed self-report metrics that accurately and reliably measure individual happiness. So how do the scientists define happiness? Essentially, as the experience of positive emotions, pleasure combined with deeper feelings of meaning and purpose. Happiness implies a positive mood in the present and a positive outlook for the future. Martin Seligman, the pioneer in positive psychology, has broken it down into three measurable components: pleasure, engagement, and meaning. His studies have confirmed, though most of us know this intuitively, that people who pursue only pleasure experience only part of the benefits happiness can bring, while those who pursue all three routes lead the fullest lives. Perhaps the most accurate term for happiness, then, is the one Aristotle used, eudaimonia, which translates not directly to happiness, but to human flourishing. This definition really resonates with me because it acknowledges that happiness is not all about yellow smiley faces and rainbows. For me, happiness is the joy we feel striving after our potential. The chief engine of happiness is positive emotions, since happiness is, above all else, a feeling. In fact, some researchers prefer the term positive emotions or positivity to happiness, because while they are essentially synonymous, happiness is a far more vague and unwieldy term. Barbara Fredrickson, a researcher at the University of North Carolina, and perhaps the world's leading expert on the subject, describes the 10 most common positive emotions: joy, gratitude, serenity, interest, hope, pride, amusement, inspiration, awe, and love. This paints a far richer picture of happiness than the ubiquitous yellow smiley face, which doesn't leave much room for nuance. Still, for ease of discussion, you will find that throughout this audio program, the terms positive emotions, positivity, and happiness are all used interchangeably. Whatever you call it, our tireless pursuit of this feeling is part of our unique humanity, a fact that has been chronicled by writers and philosophers far more eloquent than I, including Thomas Jefferson and the United States' founding document. But as we are about to see, happiness is even more than a good feeling. It is also an indispensable ingredient of our success. The happiness advantage at work. In the introduction, I mentioned the impressive meta-analysis of happiness research that brought together the results of over 200 scientific studies on nearly 275,000 people, and found that happiness leads to success in nearly every domain of our lives, including marriage, health, friendship, community involvement, creativity, and in particular, our jobs, careers, and businesses. Data abounds showing that happy workers have higher levels of productivity, produce higher sales, perform better in leadership positions, and receive higher performance ratings and higher pay. They also enjoy more job security and are less likely to take sick days, to quit, or to become burned out. Happy CEOs are more likely to lead teams of employees who are both happy and healthy, and who find their work climate conducive to high performance. The list of the benefits of happiness in the workplace goes on and on. The chicken or the egg. At this point, you might be thinking, maybe people are happy because they are more productive and earn higher pay. As psychology graduate students are taught to repeat ad nauseum, correlation is not causation. In other words, studies often only tell us that two things are related. To find out which causes which, we need to look at it more closely and find out which came first. So which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Does happiness come before success, or success before happiness? If happiness were just the end result of being successful, the prevailing creed at companies and schools would be correct. Focus on productivity and performance, even to the detriment of our emotional and physical well-being, and we will eventually become more successful and therefore happier. But thanks to strides in positive psychology, this myth has been debunked. As the authors of the survey were able to say conclusively, study after study shows that happiness precedes important outcomes and indicators of thriving. In short, based on the wealth of data they compiled, they found that happiness causes success and achievement, not the opposite. Let's look more closely at how. One way psychologists attempt to answer the chicken or the egg question is to follow people over long periods. One study, for example, measured the initial level of positive emotions in 272 employees, then followed their job performance over the next 18 months. And they found that even after controlling for other factors, those who were happier at the beginning ended up receiving better evaluations and higher pay later on. Another study found that how happy individuals were as college freshmen predicted how high their income was 19 years later, regardless of their initial level of wealth. One of the most famous longitudinal studies on happiness comes from an unlikely place, the old diaries of Catholic nuns. These 180 nuns from the School Sisters of Notre Dame, all born before 1917, were asked to write down their thoughts in autobiographical journal entries. More than five decades later, a clever group of researchers decided to code the entries for positive emotional content. Could their level of positivity as 20-year-olds predict how the rest of their lives turned out? In fact, yes. The nuns whose journal entries had more overtly joyful content lived nearly 10 years longer than the nuns whose entries were more negative or neutral. By age 85, 90% of the happiest quartile of nuns were still alive, compared to only 34% of the least happy quartile. Clearly, the nuns who were happy at 20 didn't feel that way because they knew they would go on to live longer. Their superior health and longer lifespans could only be the result of their happiness, not the cause. This study highlights another clue to answering the chicken or the egg question. Happiness can improve our physical health, which in turn keeps us working faster and longer, and therefore makes us more likely to succeed. This revelation provides companies an additional incentive to care about employee happiness, since healthy employees will be more productive on the job. Research shows that unhappy employees take more sick days, staying home an average of 1.25 more days per month, or 15 extra sick days per year. And again, studies have determined that happiness functions as the cause, not just the result, of good health. In one study I'm glad I never volunteered to take part in, researchers gave subjects a survey designed to measure levels of happiness, then injected them with a strain of the cold virus. A week later, the individuals who were happier before the start of the study had fought off the virus much better than the less happy individuals. They didn't just feel better either. They actually had fewer objective symptoms of illness as measured by doctors, less sneezing, coughing, inflammation, and congestion. What this means is that companies and leaders who take measures to cultivate a happy workplace will not only have more productive and efficient workers, they'll have less absenteeism and lower healthcare expenditures. Your brain on happiness. In addition to these longitudinal studies, scientists discovered more proof that happiness causes success when they started examining how positive emotions affect our brain function and change our behavior. Psychologists have long known that negative emotions narrow our thoughts and range of actions, which has served an important evolutionary purpose. In prehistoric times, if a saber-toothed tiger was running at you, fear and stress helped release chemicals that either prepared you to fight the tiger, which admittedly might not go very well, or flee from him, a contest you again might lose. Still, these were both better options than doing nothing and simply waiting to be attacked. So what evolutionary purpose would positive emotions have? Until recently, scientists were content to say that happiness merely makes us feel good, and end the inquiry there. Thankfully, the last 20 years have changed all that. Extensive research has found that happiness actually has a very important evolutionary purpose, something Barbara Fredrickson has termed the broaden and build theory. Instead of narrowing our actions down to fight or flight, as negative emotions do, positive ones broaden the amount of possibilities we process, making us more thoughtful, creative, and open to new ideas. For instance, individuals who are primed, meaning scientists help evoke a certain mindset or emotion before doing an experiment, to feel either amusement or contentment, can think of a larger and wider array of thoughts and ideas than individuals who've been primed to feel either anxiety or anger. And when positive emotions broaden our scope of cognition and behavior in this way, they not only make us more creative, they help us build more intellectual, social, and physical resources we can rely upon in the future. Recent research shows that this broadening effect is actually biological, that happiness gives us a real chemical edge on the competition. How? Positive emotions flood our brain with dopamine and serotonin, chemicals that not only make us feel good, but dial up the learning centers of our brain to higher levels. They help us to organize new information, keep that information in the brain longer, and retrieve it faster later on. And they enable us to make and sustain more neural connections, which allows us to think more quickly and creatively, becoming more skilled at complex analysis and problem solving, and see and invent new ways of doing things. We even quite literally see more of what's around us when we're feeling happy. A recent University of Toronto study found that our mood can actually change how our visual cortex, the part of our brain responsible for sight, processes information. In this experiment, people were primed for either positivity or negativity, then asked to look at a series of pictures. Those who were put in the negative mood didn't process all the images in the pictures, missing substantial parts of the background, while those in a good mood saw everything. Eye-tracking experiments have shown the same thing. Positive emotions actually expand our peripheral line of vision. Think of the edge all this gives us in the workplace. After all, who wouldn't want to see out-of-the-box solutions, spot opportunities, and better see how to build upon the ideas of others? In today's innovation-driven knowledge economy, business success in practically every job or profession hinges upon being able to find creative and novel solutions to problems. For example, when researchers at Merck first began studying the effects of a drug called finasteride, they were intent on finding a cure for benign prostatic hyperplasia, otherwise known as enlarged prostate. During checkups with the research subjects, though, they learned that many of the participants were experiencing a weird side effect. They were regrowing hair. Fortunately, the Merck researchers could see the billion-dollar product hiding in the unexpected side effect, and Propecia was born. The happiness advantage is why cutting-edge software companies have foosball tables in the employee lounge, why Yahoo has an in-house massage parlor, and why Google engineers are encouraged to bring their dogs to work. These aren't just PR gimmicks. Smart companies cultivate these kinds of working environments because every time employees experience a small burst of happiness, they get primed for creativity and innovation. They see solutions they might otherwise have missed. Famed CEO Richard Branson has said that more than any other element, fun is the secret of virgin success. This isn't just because fun is, well, fun. It's because fun also leads to bottom line results. Jell-O at lunch. Positive emotions can begin to open our eyes and minds to new solutions and ideas even at a very young age. In one interesting study, researchers asked 4-year-old children to complete a series of learning tasks, such as putting together blocks of different shapes. The first group was given neutral instructions. Please put these blocks together as quickly as you can. The researchers gave the second group the same set of instructions, then asked them to first briefly think about something that makes them happy. Now, at only 4 years of age, these kids obviously don't have a wealth of happy experiences to choose from. They can't look back on career accomplishments or wedding days or first kisses, we hope. So most likely, they thought about something along the lines of the Jell-O they had at lunch. Still, it was enough to make a difference. The children who were primed to be happy significantly outperformed the others, completing the task both more quickly and with fewer errors. The benefits of priming the brain with positive thoughts don't end at childhood either. To the contrary, studies have found that across the board, in both academic and business settings, these same benefits persist throughout our adult lives. For instance, students who were told to think about the happiest day of their lives right before taking a standardized math test outperformed their peers, and people who expressed more positive emotions while negotiating business deals did so more efficiently and successfully than those who were more neutral or negative. The implications of these studies are undeniable. People who put their heads down and wait for work to bring eventual happiness put themselves at a huge disadvantage, while those who capitalize on positivity every chance they get come out ahead. Give the doc a lollipop. In medical school, one way aspiring doctors are trained to make diagnoses is through a version of role-playing. They're asked to diagnose hypothetical patients, usually by reading a list of the patient's current symptoms and medical history. This is a skill that requires a good deal of creativity, because diagnostic errors oftentimes result from an inflexibility in thinking, or a phenomenon called anchoring. Anchoring occurs when a doctor has trouble letting go of an initial diagnosis, the anchor point, even in the face of new information that contradicts the initial theory. If you've ever seen the television show House MD, you'll recognize how important creativity is in the field of medicine. The show's twists and turns demand that Dr. House switch from one diagnosis to another at warp speeds. The show is exaggerated, of course, but in reality, such changes are many times necessary. So to find out if positive emotions could possibly affect how well doctors make their diagnoses, a trio of researchers decided to send a group of experienced doctors back to school by giving them a series of these sets of symptoms to analyze. The doctors were split into three groups, one primed to feel happy, one given neutral but medicine-related statements to read before the exercise, and one, the control group, given nothing. The goal of the study was not only to see how fast they performed the correct diagnosis, but also how well they avoided anchoring. As it turned out, the happy doctors made the right diagnosis much faster and exhibited much more creativity. On average, they came to a correct diagnosis only 20% of the way through the manuscript, nearly twice as fast as the control group, and showed about 2.5 times less anchoring. My favorite part of the study, though, is how the doctors were primed to be happy. With candy. It didn't take a cash reward, or the promise of a promotion, or an extra week of vacation to boost their moods enough to make them twice as effective and more than twice as creative. All it took was a small gift of candy right before they started the task. And they didn't even get to eat the candy to ensure that heightened blood sugar levels didn't affect the results. This reveals something important about the happiness advantage in action. Even the smallest shots of positivity can give someone a serious competitive edge. Two implications of these results immediately come to mind. First, perhaps patients should start offering their doctors lollipops instead of the other way around. Second, and more important, perhaps hospitals should make a more concerted effort to improve the overall working conditions for doctors by improving the benefits, adding perks, or just allowing them shorter or more flexible shifts. If just a bit of candy makes our doctors more effective, imagine how much sharper, more efficient, and more creative a medical system we could have if hospital policies focused more on employee satisfaction, not just of doctors, but also of nurses, medical students, and technicians. It's not hard to see that this study, and all the others like it, have invaluable lessons to impart, not just about how we should run our hospitals, but our businesses and schools as well. The undoing effect. Brian, a salesman in Des Moines, was already feeling nervous about his upcoming presentation when he heard a knock on his office door. "Big meeting at 4, his boss reminded him. "You ready? This is huge. We need this account. Don't mess it up, buddy." As his boss proceeded down the hall, Brian felt stress coursing through his body. Even though he already had the presentation down pat, he was now so nervous that he spent the next few hours going over it again and again, trying to anticipate where he might make mistakes, and reminding himself how terrible it would be for his company to lose this account. Little did Brian know that the more he focused his mind on the potential disastrous effects of a bad presentation, the more he doomed himself to failure. While it may seem counterintuitive for many hardened businessmen, we now know that the best thing Brian could have done in this situation is find a quick jolt of happiness. Why does this work? Because in addition to broadening our intellectual and creative capacities, positive emotions also provide a swift antidote to physical stress and anxiety, what psychologists call the undoing effect. In one experiment, subjects were asked to make a difficult, time-pressured speech that they were told would be videotaped and evaluated by their peers. As you might imagine, this induced considerable anxiety and measurable increases in heart rate and blood pressure, just how Brian felt right before his presentation. The researchers then randomly assigned the participants to view 1 of 4 different videos. 2 induced feelings of joy and contentment. 1 was neutral, and the 4th was sad. Indeed, the people primed with positive feelings experienced a faster recovery from the stress and its physical effects. Not only had the happy films made them feel better, but they had undone the physiological effects of stress. In other words, a quick burst of positive emotions doesn't just broaden our cognitive capacity. It also provides a quick and powerful antidote to stress and anxiety, which in turn improves our focus and our ability to function at our best level. So instead of adding to Brian's stress by reminding him of the high stakes of the presentation, his boss would have been better served by stressing the positives with some encouraging words or a reminder of the chief strengths Brian brings to the table. Or Brian himself could have employed any number of techniques to boost positivity and build confidence. Visualizing himself giving a clear and cogent presentation, recalling a past instance when he made a successful business pitch, or taking a moment to do something entirely unrelated to his work that makes him happy. Maybe making a quick call to a friend, reading a funny article online, watching a 2-minute clip of The Daily Show, or taking a brisk walk around the block. Some of these suggestions may seem overly simple or even ridiculous in a serious work setting, but given that their worth has proven scientifically unassailable, we'd be ridiculous not to use them. Everyone has 1 or 2 quick activities they know will make them smile, and however trivial they may feel, their benefits are worth it. Capitalizing on the happiness advantage. Obviously, there are people for whom this positivity comes more naturally. Once, after I detailed the full extent of the happiness advantage at a corporate training, an exasperated executive stood up to say, "Well, that's great for happy people, Sean, but what about the rest of us? We want that edge up too." His point is a good one, and he's right that if our level of happiness were set in stone, all of this information would prove rather depressing news for the less positively inclined among us. Thankfully, that's not the case. We can all reap the full benefits of the happiness advantage if we work hard enough at it. Remember, happiness is not just a mood, it's a work ethic. Scientists once thought happiness was almost completely hereditary, dictated by a genetically determined set point. But thankfully, they have since discovered that in fact we have far more control over our emotional well-being than previously believed. While we each have a happiness baseline that we fluctuate around on a daily basis, with concerted effort, we can raise that baseline permanently so that even when we are going up and down, we are doing so at a higher level. Each principle in this audio program contributes to at least one, if not many, of the things scientists have found to be most crucial to human happiness, like pursuing meaningful life goals, scanning the world for opportunities, cultivating an optimistic and grateful mindset, and holding on to rich social relationships. As important as these larger shifts in thinking and behavior are, it's equally important to realize that the happiness advantage also lies in the small, momentary blips of positivity that pepper our lives each and every day. As we have seen, just a short, humorous video clip, a quick conversation with a friend, or even a small gift of candy could produce significant and immediate boosts in cognitive power and job performance. As Barbara Fredrickson points out, while making big changes and pursuing lasting happiness is certainly a worthy goal, when we look under the hood at the dynamics of the process, we found that we should be focusing on how we feel from day to day. With this in mind, here are a number of proven ways we can improve our moods and raise our levels of happiness throughout the day. Each activity listed below not only gives us a quick boost of positive emotions, improving our performance and focus in the moment, but if performed habitually over time, each has been shown to help permanently raise our happiness baseline. Of course, since happiness is subjective and not the same for everyone, we all have our own favorite happiness booster. Maybe yours is listening to a particular song, talking to a friend, playing basketball, petting a dog, or even cleaning your kitchen. My friend Abby gains an embarrassing amount of satisfaction from mopping the floor. Researchers have found that person activity fit is often just as important as the activity itself. So if one of the tips below doesn't resonate with you, don't force it. Find a personally tailored substitute instead. The goal is simply to lift your spirits and put you in a more positive mindset so you can reap all the benefits of the happiness advantage. Meditate. Neuroscientists have found that monks who spend years meditating actually grow their left prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain most responsible for feeling happy. But don't worry, you don't have to spend years in sequestered, celibate silence to experience a boost. Take just 5 minutes each day to watch your breath go in and out. When you do so, try to remain patient. If you find your mind drifting, just slowly bring it back to focus. Meditation takes practice, but it's one of the most powerful happiness interventions. Studies show that in the minutes right after meditating, we experience feelings of calm and contentment, as well as heightened awareness and empathy. And research even shows that regular meditation can permanently rewire the brain to raise levels of happiness, lower stress, and even improve immune function. Find something to look forward to. One study found that people who just thought about watching their favorite movie actually raised their endorphin levels by 27%. Often, the most enjoyable part of an activity is the anticipation. If you can't take the time for a vacation right now, or even a night out with your friends, put something on the calendar, even if it's a month or a year down the road. Then whenever you need a boost of happiness, remind yourself about it. Anticipating future rewards can actually light up the pleasure centers in your brain, much as the actual reward will. Commit conscious acts of kindness. A long line of empirical research, including one study of over 2,000 people, has shown that acts of altruism, giving to friends and strangers alike, decrease stress and strongly contribute to enhanced mental health. Sonja Lubomirsky, a leading researcher and author of The How of Happiness, has found that individuals told to complete 5 acts of kindness over the course of a day report feeling much happier than control groups, and that the feeling lasts for many subsequent days, far after the exercise is over. To try this yourself, pick one day a week and make a point of committing 5 acts of kindness. But if you want to reap the psychological benefit, make sure you do these things deliberately and consciously. You can't just look back over the last 24 hours and declare your acts post hoc. Oh yeah, I held the door for that guy coming out of the bank. That was nice. And they need not be grand gestures either. One of my favorite acts is paying the toll of somebody behind me on the Mass Pike. Being able to counter the negative effects of traffic-induced stress is $2 well spent in my book. Infuse positivity into your surroundings. As you'll hear more about in the next chapter, our physical environment can have an enormous impact on our mindset and sense of well-being. While we may not always have complete control over our surroundings, we can make specific efforts to infuse them with positivity. Think about your office. What feelings does it inspire? People who flank their computers with pictures of loved ones aren't just decorating. They're ensuring a hit of positive emotion each time they glance in that direction. Making time to go outside on a nice day also delivers a huge advantage. One study found that spending 20 minutes outside in good weather not only boosted positive mood, but broadened thinking and improved working memory. The smartest bosses encourage employees to get a breath of fresh air at least once a day, and they reap the benefits in heightened team performance. We can also change our surroundings to keep negative emotions at bay. If stock tickers send your mood into a tailspin every time you glance their way, turn off CNBC. For that matter, you might also try watching less TV in general. Studies have shown that the less negative TV we watch, specifically violent media, the happier we are. This doesn't mean shutting ourselves off from the real world or ignoring our problems. Psychologists have found that people who watch less TV are actually more accurate judges of life's risks and rewards than those who subject themselves to the tales of crime, tragedy, and death that appear night after night on the 10 o'clock news. That's because these people are less likely to see sensationalized or one-sided sources of information, and thus see reality more clearly. Exercise. You have probably heard that exercise releases pleasure-inducing chemicals called endorphins, but that's not its only benefit. Physical activity can boost mood and enhance our work performance in a number of other ways as well, by improving motivation and feelings of mastery, reducing stress and anxiety, and helping us to get into flow, that locked-in feeling of total engagement that we usually get when we're at our most productive. One study proved just how powerful exercise can be. 3 groups of depressed patients were assigned to different coping strategies. One group took antidepressant medication. One group exercised for 45 minutes, 3 times a week, and one group did a combination of both. After 4 months, all 3 groups experienced similar improvements in happiness. The very fact that exercise proved just as helpful as antidepressants is remarkable. But the story doesn't end here. The groups were then tested 6 months later to assess their relapse rate. Of those who had taken the medication alone, 38% had slipped back into depression. Those in the combination group were doing only slightly better, with a 31% relapse rate. The biggest shock, though, came from the exercise group. Their relapse rate was only 9%. In short, physical activity is not just an incredibly powerful mood lifter, but a long-lasting one. Walk, bike, run, play, stretch, jump rope, pogo stick, it doesn't matter as long as you get moving. Spend money, but not on stuff. Contrary to the popular saying, money can buy happiness, but only if used to do things as opposed to simply have things. In his book Luxury Fever, Robert Frank explains that while the positive feelings we get from the material objects are frustratingly fleeting, spending money on experiences, especially ones with other people, produces positive emotions that are both meaningful and more lasting. For instance, when researchers interviewed more than 150 people about their recent purchases, they found that the money spent on activities, such as concerts and group dinners out, brought far more pleasure than material purchases like shoes, televisions, or expensive watches. Spending money on other people, called pro-social spending, also boosts happiness. In one experiment, 46 students were given $20 to spend. The ones who were told to spend the money on others, for instance, by treating a friend to lunch, buying a toy for a younger sister, or donating to charity, were happier at the end of the day than those who had been instructed to spend the money on themselves. What are your own spending habits? Draw two columns on a piece of paper, or take 10 minutes of work to create a nifty spreadsheet, and track your purchases over the next month. Are you spending more on things or on experiences? At the end of the month, look back over each column and think about the pleasure each purchase brought you, and for how long. You may quickly find yourself wanting to reapportion money from your having column to your doing column. Exercise a signature strength. Everyone is good at something. Perhaps you give excellent advice, or you're great with little kids, or you whip up a mean batch of blueberry pancakes. Each time we use a skill, whatever it is, we experience a burst of positivity. If you find yourself in need of a happiness booster, revisit a talent you haven't used in a while. Even more fulfilling than using a skill, though, is exercising a strength of character, a trait that is deeply embedded in who we are. A team of psychologists recently cataloged 24 cross-cultural character strengths that most contribute to human flourishing. They then developed a comprehensive survey that identifies an individual's top five, or signature, strengths. To learn what's in your own top five, go to www.viasurvey.org and take the survey for free. When 577 volunteers were encouraged to pick one of their signature strengths and use it in a new way each day for a week, they became significantly happier and less depressed than control groups. And these benefits lasted. Even after the experiment was over, their levels of happiness remained heightened a full 6 months later. Studies have shown that the more you use your signature strengths in daily life, the happier you become. One of mine is the love of learning, and I feel noticeably depleted on days that I don't find an opportunity to use this strength. So I find ways to incorporate learning into some of my boring daily tasks. For instance, I have to travel nearly 300 days a year for my work, and the continuous stream of airports and hotels can weigh on my mental health. I'd love to sit in a museum in each new city, but unfortunately, I often can't spare the time. So I decided that for each new place I visit, I would learn one historical fact. Even the small cognitive exercise makes an enormous difference in my mindset as I wing my way across the continents. So take the survey to find out your own signature strengths, then try to incorporate at least one of them into your life each day. As you integrate these happiness exercises into your daily life, you'll not only start to feel better, but you'll also start to notice how your enhanced positivity makes you more efficient, motivated, and productive, and opens up opportunities for greater achievement. But the happiness advantage doesn't end there. By changing the way you work and the way you lead the people around you, you can enhance the success of your team and your whole organization. Putting the horse before the cart. Leading with a happiness advantage. Anyone can send ripples of positivity throughout their workplace. But one thing I found in my work with managers and companies is that this is even more true for leaders or people in a position of authority, mainly because, A, they determine company policies and shape the workplace culture. B, they are often expected to set an example for their employees. And C, they tend to interact with the most people over the course of the day. Sadly, in the modern workplace, leaders often scoff at the idea that focusing on happiness can have real bottom-line results. Bosses and managers have a tendency to honor the employees who can go the longest without breaks or vacations, and those who don't waste their time socializing. Few executives encourage their employees to take time out from their workdays for exercise or meditation, or allow them to leave 30 minutes early one night a week to do some local volunteering, even though the research proves the return on investment for each of these activities is huge. Even more misguided, though, are the managers who discourage even the activities that involve relatively little time investment. Most of the people I work with admit that they would be embarrassed or ashamed if the boss walked by as they were laughing in a YouTube video, or talking to their 5-year-old son on the phone, or telling a joke to a colleague in the hallway. And yet, as we've seen, all these practices provide exactly the kinds of quick bursts of positive emotion that can improve our performance on the job. And the bosses who discourage positivity in their employees are at a double disadvantage, because these tend to be people who are most negative themselves. In short, sacrificing positivity in the name of time management and efficiency actually slows us down. The best leaders use the happiness advantage as a tool to motivate their teams and maximize employee potential. We all know how this can be done on an organizational level. Google is famous for keeping scooters in the hallway, video games in the break room, and gourmet chefs in the cafeteria. The founder of Patagonia instituted a "Let My People Go Surfing" policy. Should the mood strike you, he told employees, grab a surfboard from the office closet and hit the waves. The data couldn't be clearer that these policies, as well as more conventional happiness boosters like gym memberships, health benefits, and on-site daycare, consistently deliver big dividends. Coors Brewing Company, for example, reported a $6.15 return in profitability for every $1 spent on its corporate fitness program. Toyota saw an instant jump in its productivity at its North American parts center when it instituted a strength-based training for its employees. But it's true, too, that you don't have to make sweeping policy changes like these to capitalize on the happiness advantage. As we have seen, even the smallest moments of positivity in the workplace can enhance efficiency, motivation, creativity, and productivity. One way to do this is simply to provide frequent recognition and encouragement. As studies have shown, managers who do so see a substantial increase in their employees' productivity, and not just by some small amount. One study found that project teams with encouraging managers performed 31% better than teams whose managers were less positive and less open with praise. In fact, when recognition is specific and deliberately delivered, is even more motivating than money. Recognition can be given in traditional ways: a complimentary email, a pat on the back for a job well done, but you can also get creative with it. One of my favorite examples is one a business consultant cites about a Danish car company that instituted the Order of the Elephant. The elephant is a 2-foot-tall stuffed animal that any employee can give to another one as a reward for doing something exemplary. The benefits come not just in the delivery and reception of well-earned praise, but afterward as well. As he explains, other employees stopping by immediately notice the elephant and go, "Hey, you got the elephant. What did you do?" Which of course means that the good stories and best practices get told and retold many times. Chip Conley, CEO of a wildly successful chain of boutique hotels, makes time at the end of his executive meetings to allow one person to talk for 1 minute about someone in the company who deserves recognition. It could be a peer or someone many ranks down, a manager or a maid. After the executive has spoken for 1 minute about why this employee deserves recognition, A different executive at the meeting volunteers to call, email, or visit that employee to tell him or her what a great job that employee is doing. This isn't just a nicety. The benefits here are far-reaching. The recognized employee obviously feels great, as do both the executive who made the recommendation and the executive who gets to deliver the praise. Everyone else gets a mood boost as well. They get to hear about the good work being done at their company, and then they spend the next few days thinking about the good work of other employees they'd like to recommend during the next meeting. Just as important as what you say to the employees is how you say it. The best leaders know that delivering instructions in an angry, negative tone handicaps their employees before the task is even underway. One study done at the Yale School of Management paints this picture perfectly. Student volunteers were put in teams to do business tasks together with the goal of earning money for an imaginary company. Then in came the manager, who was actually an actor instructed to speak in one of four ways: with cheerful enthusiasm, serene warmth, depressed sluggishness, or hostile irritability. Of these four groups, which two do you think not only became more positive themselves, but proved far more effective than the other groups, winning their companies more profit in the end? Now think about which of these four tones you most often use. It might surprise you, we're often entirely unaware of the messages we're sending. I remember once, during a talk, one woman in the audience sat scowling at me the entire time. But then afterward, she was one of the people who waited in line to tell me personally how much she loved the presentation. I was shocked. Then I thought about how much negativity she was probably spreading to her employees on a daily basis without even knowing it. So the next time you interact with a colleague or direct report, make an effort to adopt a more positive tone and facial expression. This does not mean you should be inauthentic, smother your true feelings, or paint an awkward smile on your face. But the more you make a genuine effort to avoid slipping into an apathetic or irritable tone, the more your team's performance will benefit. This isn't only true in corporate settings. In environments thought to be even more stoic than corporate America, like the military, leaders who openly express their positivity get the most out of their teams. In the United States Navy, researchers found annual prizes for efficiency and preparedness are far more frequently awarded to squadrons whose commanding officers are openly encouraging. On the other hand, the squadrons receiving the lowest marks in performance are generally led by commanders with a negative, controlling, and aloof demeanor. Even in an environment where one would think that the harsh, military taskmaster style of leadership would be most effective, positivity wins out. The Lasada Line. Sure, there will always be naysayers and skeptics who admit that happiness may make work more enjoyable, but resist the notion that it can give us real, measurable competitive advantage. This is too bad. Maybe they think focusing on happiness in a serious business setting is unnatural or a waste of time and effort, or maybe they believe that encouragement and recognition should be used as rewards for high performance, not as tools for driving it. And for some leaders, positivity simply comes less naturally than it does for others. As one London bank executive responded after I shared an idea for how he could infuse some positivity into his workplace, "That's a great idea. I'll never do it." To help these people capitalize on the happiness advantage, I often recommend that they keep one thing in mind, the number 2.9013. This may seem random, but a decade of research on high and low performance teams by psychologist and business consultant Marcio Lozada shows just how important it is. Based on Lozada's extensive mathematical modeling, 2.9013 is the ratio of positive to negative interactions necessary to make a corporate team successful. This means that it takes about 3 positive comments, experiences, or expressions to fend off the languishing effects of 1 negative. Dip below this tipping point, now known as the Lasada line, and workplace performance quickly suffers. Rise above it, ideally the research shows to a ratio of 6 to 1, and teams produce their very best work. This is not just some arcane mathematical formula either. Losada himself observed countless examples of it in action. For instance, he once worked with a global mining company suffering from process losses greater than 10%. Unsurprisingly, he found that their positivity ratio was only 1.15. But after team leaders were instructed to give more positive feedback and encourage more positive interactions, their team's average ratio increased to 3.56. And in turn, they made giant strides in production, improving their performance by over 40%. Though originally skeptical, the company's CEO couldn't help but exult in the notable transformation. He confided to Losada, "You untied knots that imprisoned us. Today we look at each other differently, we trust each other more, we learn to disagree without being disagreeable, we care not only about our personal success, but about the success of others. Most important, we obtain tangible results." Losada's mathematical ratio joins the increasingly long line of evidence in support of the happiness advantage. Just one more way that groundbreaking science has triggered a Copernican revolution in the workplace. Once we accept this new order in the working universe, that happiness is the center around which success orbits, we can change the way we work, interact with colleagues, and lead our teams to give our own careers and our whole organizations the competitive edge. Principle number 2, the fulcrum and the lever, changing your performance by changing your mindset. I fell for psychology the day my sister fell off the bed. Once, when I was 7 years old, my sister Amy and I were playing on the top of our bunk beds. At the time, Amy was 2 years younger. Incidentally, she still is. And at that time, that meant she had to do whatever I wanted to do. I wanted to play war. I'm from Texas. So I lined up all my G.I. Joes and soldiers on my side of the top bunk against all her My Little Ponies and unicorns on the other side. I felt confident about the outcome. You don't have to know a lot about military history to know that very rarely have unicorns ever defeated soldiers on a battlefield. However, there are differing accounts of what happened at the climax of the battle. I'm the one telling the story, so I'll tell you the true version. My sister got a little too excited, and without any help from me, fell off of the top bunk. I heard a crash on the floor, and I nervously peered over the side of the bed to see what had befallen my fallen sibling. Amy had landed on the floor on her hands and knees, on all fours. Now I was nervous. First, because my sister was and is my best friend. More important, though, I had been charged by my parents with ensuring that my sister and I play as quietly and safely as possible, as they were settling down for a long winter's nap. I looked at my sister's face and noticed that a wail of pain and suffering was about to erupt from her mouth, threatening to wake my parents from their rest. Crisis is the mother of all invention, so I did the only thing my frantic little 7-year-old brain could think to do. I said, "Amy, wait, wait. Did you see how you landed? No human lands on all fours like that. You're a unicorn." Now this was absolutely cheating, for I knew that there was nothing in the world my sister wanted more than for the world to realize that she was not Amy the 5-year-old, but Amy the special unicorn. The wail froze in my sister's throat as confusion took over her face. You could see the conflict in her eyes as her brain tried to decide whether to focus on the physical pain she was feeling or her excitement about her newfound identity as a unicorn. And the latter won out. Instead of crying, waking my parents, and all the negative consequences that would have ensued, a smile spread across her face, and she proudly bound back up to the top of the bed with all the grace of a baby unicorn. My sister and I had no idea that what we stumbled across at the tender age of 5 and 7 would be at the vanguard of a scientific revolution occurring 2 decades later. No, we did not learn that you can lie to someone and manipulate them into being happy in the face of pain and suffering. What we learned was much more powerful, a scientific truth about the human brain. Although we would never have used these words, my sister and I began to realize that our brains are like a single processor, capable of devoting only a finite amount of resources to experiencing the world. Because our brain's resources are limited, we are left with a choice. To use those finite resources to see only pain, negativity,